people came here fleeing the persecution in their home countries because of what the U.S. has done there, and then are being doubly persecuted here. I mean, people need to hear these stories. And I think that the more that they hear them, the more positive response there's been of people being outraged, like, why are you doing this to these people?
How they went and got my husband's name to begin with is that they had went back to INS and cross-referenced off nationality, whether they were citizens at the time they got their SBA loans or not. Had nothing to do with any kind of criminal activity whatsoever.
This is how they've established a lot of the repressive mechanism, is through going after the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants. I mean, this is how they've laid the basis for a police state in this country.
And I would say this is not prosecution of Muslims, this is persecution of Muslims.
In the wake of September 11th, the U.S. government has been using old laws and passing new ones in the name of safety. Those targeted by these new laws have been deported, jailed, and otherwise repressed. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we focus on the case of Khan Hafiz, the work of the Blue Triangle Network in response to the repression of Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians, and later, the potential hazards of the passing of the Real ID Bill, which is in front of Congress right now. Stay tuned.
First, we'll be hearing from Aisha Hafiz, the wife of Khan Hafiz, a Pakistani convenience store owner in Houston, Texas, who is facing 30 years in prison after being swept up in Operation Fleeced America, a government sting operation led by the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration, and Customs Enforcement.
Back in August of last year, right before the election, my husband, he was arrested on a false claim of citizenship. And then when they submitted the papers, the document in front of him, of course, he noted, he had to admit that, yes, he signed it, but he didn't check off that he was a United States citizen. It was computer checked off. And, it's been a nightmare ever since. Well, I told him because he didn't do this, and he didn't knowingly do it. He didn't even know that the page had ever been signed. You know, because at an SBA closing, there's so many documents you sign and date, sign and date, sign and date, and everything. And that's what he did. He signed and date and paid, like every normal American does. And he's still paying on this loan as of today, even now we're in this trouble. And since then, you know, how do I say? They went and they charged 11 Pakistani people and one set of brothers who were Vietnamese. The reason I feel that they charged the Vietnamese people was because of the fact that they had a past fraud conviction. They didn't have a choice but to charge them. Plus, I feel that they knew that they would get off because their parents were already American citizens. So, you know, they had all these Pakistani people. And then they turned around and they told my husband, well, if you don't take a voluntary deportation and plead guilty to the charges, all the plea charges that they forwarded to our attorney, every single one of them were deportable, deportable, deportable. And I've got three small children with my husband. And I told him, I said, you know, this means you'll never come back to America. You know, I've never been to Pakistan in my whole entire life. And never have had no desire, and I don't want my children being separated from their father, and I feel that this was an innocent mistake, and it's not something that he did, so why should he be accountable for this thing? Well, in the meanwhile, they go back and they charge these people and they threaten them, if you don't plead guilty to this and take a voluntary deportation, then we are going to charge you criminally and convict you of bank fraud, which carries a 30 years prison sentence. And my husband and I, you know, we thought it over and everything, and at first, you know, everybody that we had talked to and everything that were Pakistani, all of them had told us, well, you should plead guilty and just take all your assets, sell everything, and go back to Pakistan and live. But because of the principle of the matter that we didn't feel that he had done anything, you know, I said no. And so then they went in and they charged him with bank fraud. I mean, I know that there's a lot of pressure on the Muslim community right now because of 9/11, but I'm not related to Osama bin Laden, neither is my husband. He's not a terrorist. All he does is work to pay his SBA loan, just like any other person does.
What is the SBA?
SBA is Small Business Administration. When you go to buy a business, you go to the bank and you get a loan for Small Business Association, which is for immigrants and women. You know, as long as you put your alien number down, you're entitled to get an SBA loan the same way as your citizen does, same exact way. There's no benefits in lying. There was no benefit in lying whatsoever. Again, my husband, he did not know anything about, you know, SBA loans, nothing. I mean, he was drugged there by these people. The guy who was the seller had hooked him up with the bank person and the appraiser and just everybody, you know. And my husband just thought, well, okay, well, you know, he's been here for a long time. He's established and he knows people. I don't know anybody, but I want to buy the business. That's it. And he's made the payments on time, never been late. Never been late, not that first time, not even now. And it's just, it's really a nightmare. It really is. But that's what Small Business Administration is.
So earlier when we began talking, you had mentioned that there was a checkbox that had been electronically or computer generated.
Checked off, right. Exactly.
And has that been given as evidence that your husband is innocent?
Yes. I mean, everything we have tried to cooperate with the prosecutors, and at first they were telling us, well, if you just tell us why this was done, you know, we're not out to cook anybody. We're not out to hurt anybody. Well, you know, we have done more than the average people that they convicted and people who are fighting it. We've tried to cooperate with them and cooperate them and cooperate with them. Even our attorney said, why are you giving them, you know, defense and everything? And then the other day they went before the judge and the prosecutor, you know, because they took my passport away from me. And I've heard horror stories how they come out to your house after they convict your husband and take your children from you. And I don't want my children to be taken from me. I'm sorry, but I don't. You know, yes, of course, if you throw my husband in prison, who wouldn't be depressed? You know what I'm saying? But, you know, I've heard horror stories from people that their husbands have been thrown in detention and being deported, how they show up at the door 3 days later and they try to take your children from CPS, tries to take custody of your children. And I was like, this is not going to happen to me. So I was asking for my passport to be given back to me. And they were saying, well, you know, don't you see, Judge, she's going to take her kids and she's going to flee to Pakistan and he's going to be right behind her. And the judge said, well, out of everything that I read out of this whole case, which there's not a whole lot of jail time, you're just out to deport him. Is that right? And he said, yes, yes, I am. He gladly said, yes, he was. And what for? I have no earthly idea. I know this man was over there in Baghdad killing Iraqi people, but you know what? My son is in the Marines over in Iraq, too. It seems to be here in the Houston something is going on in the Dallas area, because I've done a lot of research myself trying to figure out what happened, what was going on, or you know, just anything I could find. Through the motion for selective prosecution, I mean, you would notice that all the people that were arrested were all Pakistani. And then I went up and I put in, I wanted to see if there was any kind of something going on, and I put, you know, what they had charged him with, false claim of citizenship, and it pulled up a story up in the Dallas area. And it was through the Dallas Business Journal. It was called Breaking the Banks. And it seemed to be that, you know, all the people that were arrested here in Houston had the same bank, Bank United. All the bank people in the Dallas had the same bank, Bank United. And, you know, from my investigation, it seems as though that what they do is they criminally convict all the people and get them charged and convicted and deported, and then they go after the American title companies and the banks who did wrong. You know, and it's not fair, because what they do is they use the same dialogue that they were part of a scheme to defraud SBA, and my husband was not part of a scheme because he had just moved here from New York and didn't know a soul and had come across a gentleman who had a business card like he was some kind of real estate agent and had prior experience selling real estate. He was just looking for a business to buy, and, you know, the guy had told him, you know, don't worry about it. I'll help you get the loan. My husband had never had an SBA loan, and he just, you know, thought, well, if he knows how to get a loan and help me get a loan, then I'll, you know, pay the price, because the funds look like, you know, that in over time I would be able to recover from what I'm having to pay for the business and everything. Well, he bought the business, and everybody just looks at numbers, you know, and that's what he did. And now since then, I mean, it's just been one nightmare after the other nightmare, and it's just horrible. And I would say this is not prosecution of Muslims. This is persecution of Muslims, because this is just not fair. I mean, you know, if he had done something himself to deceive SBA, that's one thing. But they're saying that he took a loan from the seller. The seller has been paid back every penny. He took a loan from SBA. SBA has been paid back. The whole entire loan was $880,000, $475,000. Has been paid back to the American economy. He hasn't cheated not one person, not one person in this regard. The loan is still current. And also, I want to bring this to your attention. I just did some research online myself, and I pulled up where you go to SBA. I put in Operation Fleeced America in the dog pile web search. This is just not a isolated incident. This happened in Dallas too, and according to another attorney in the Dallas region, he says it's happening all over the United States, which I didn't really know it was happening all over the United States, but apparently it is, because I noticed in my husband's documentation they put Operation Fleeced America.
Do you think Operation Fleeced America came first, and then the charges?
I think what happened is, since all of the rules changed back in 1996, for immigration, that this was something that the FBI developed, and slowly they have been enforcing this. Of course, God knows, I mean, you can't keep up with what they change, but anytime you make false claim to citizenship on any, even an employment application, or somebody assumes that you were a citizen at the time, then, you know, you're in trouble because of them assuming. You see what I'm saying? And but it seems like that's what's happened. And since that, we have found that the title company that was involved is under investigation. The bank employee that was involved in doing the loan, he was fired from Bank United for getting illegal kickbacks. So it just seems to be some kind of big scam or something going on, which my husband obviously fell into some kind of trap or something. I don't know, but it just seems if he was a victim, I wouldn't be screaming he's innocent. I would be quiet, be ashamed, and keep my mouth shut and get deported and face the consequences. You know, you do the crime, you pay the time kind of situation. But I know my husband, and I know he's not, you know, he didn't do this. I know this, and he's just, you know, being set up because he's an immigrant. That's all it is. Well, when I went to the dog pile search engine, I put in Operation Fleeced America. It came up with the SBA semi-annual report of Inspector General for SBA's documentation. It says report to Congress, and it mentions in there working with a number of other law enforcement agencies. So this is not just going to be an isolated incident. It's going to continue to happen and happen slowly, slowly, slowly throughout the United States.
This is Travis Morales of Houston, Texas, who is a representative of the Blue Triangle Network. The Blue Triangle Network is an advocacy group and works by disseminating information on the attacks on Arabs, Muslims, and South Asians. How long has Operation Fleeced America been around?
Okay, I don't know the exact dates, but it's only been like, I think, the last two or three years they've been doing this. I mean, from my understanding and reading things, what Operation Fleeced America is, because it's an ongoing operation, is the federal government has been investigating Pakistani convenience store owners based upon the fact that they're Pakistanis. And Operation Fleeced America is a specific campaign to go after and arrest people that they claim fraudulently obtained Small Business Administration loans to finance purchases of a convenience store, and supposedly lied on these applications saying that they were U.S. citizens when, in fact, according to the government, they were not. And that's what Operation Fleeced America is. And what they did was they took a list of people who'd gotten Small Business Administration loans and then went to the Bureau of Immigration and Custom Enforcement as well as some other law enforcement agencies and said, okay, we want you to run these people through your computers and tell us who are U.S. citizens, who are not, and basically decided to indict Pakistanis. I mean, it's like very much driven by people's nationality. And that's how Hafiz and some of these other people have been arrested in this supposedly stopping SBA fraud. But in the case of Hafiz, for instance, he's never, I mean, they have never been late on a loan. They've been paying it for the last 6 years. They're current, but yet they're still going after them for bank fraud, you know, for supposedly claiming he was a U.S. citizen when he wasn't. As anyone who's ever filled out a bank loan paperwork knows, I mean, there's like 20 pages. I mean, just pages and pages, and you just go through and you sign the bottom. You don't even look at what's been checked by the computer of the bank. So he got caught up in this. And when he refused, as most of the other people who were arrested, when he refused to plead guilty and be deported, then they slapped on these other charges claiming that at the time he got the loan, he didn't reveal to the SBA that he'd gotten another loan to make the down payment and that he didn't put I forget how many tens of thousands of dollars he was supposed to put into the business to improve it, that he hadn't done that. But it's all just part of piling on charges when it's pretty obvious that it's the whole thing, by their own admission, was driven by investigating Pakistanis, investigating people who had bought convenience stores who weren't citizens. So it's definitely very much a question of selective prosecution. And
do you know why they focused on Pakistani immigrants, and is there a big community in Houston?
There is a big community in Houston. There's a big community in Dallas as well. But if you go back and you do all the research and everything, you'll find that how they went and got my husband's name to begin with is that they had went back to INS and cross-referenced off nationality, whether they were citizens at the time they got their SBA loans or not. Had nothing to do with any kind of criminal activity whatsoever.
There are a lot of Pakistani small business owners, I know, in the Houston area and in other parts of the country. I mean, I think it might have something to do, too, with sort of the political situation in Pakistan. It's one of these U.S.-funded dictators that's sitting on top of a population that very much does not like it and does not like the U.S. So I think it's part of just terrorizing these whole communities that are here, as well as demonizing these communities in the eyes of people in this country.
And it seems like there's a lot of risks for people that are indicted for those charges. It really does seem like Hafiz is facing some retaliation for deciding to actually fight it when he doesn't believe he did anything wrong.
Right. He's married, has several kids here, said he wasn't guilty of anything because he wasn't. And so then they piled on these other charges, you know, claiming bank fraud when, again, they've never been late on their loan. They're current. That's not really the driving issue. The driving issue is the fact that he's Pakistani and he's not a citizen.
So what's going on with his case right now?
Well, they're scheduled for trial for June 13th, and that's when they're going for trying to put him away for 30 years. I mean, that's what he's facing. On the surface, I mean, you look at it, again, as I said earlier, anyone who's filled out a bank loan papers knows that you don't read every page. You don't look at everything. I mean, it's impossible. People just sign at the bottom and keep going, and that apparently is basically what happened to him. And there was a box that was checked by the bank, not by him, that said he was a U.S. citizen, despite the fact that he'd given them his Social Security card, which clearly said he was not a U.S. citizen because it's something about may work with authorization only, but yet they're claiming that he was trying to say he was a citizen. It's very serious. I mean, he is facing 30 years in prison and deportation. Again, it's retaliation because just about all the other people who were arrested chose deportation rather than go through this whole process.
You were saying that when people have immigration charges, it's a civil suit, but because he is contesting that, now they have put criminal charges on him as well?
Well, most people, when they come up on immigration violations, it's a civil matter. It's not a criminal matter. And so a lot of the rights that people have in a criminal cases don't apply in immigration cases. But his original charge was that he claimed false citizenship, which is a criminal case.
How did the Blue Triangle Network get hooked up with this case in particular?
Aisha called us.
And are there anyone else that's been indicted through Operation Fleeced America that's fighting it?
as far as we can tell, and Hafiz is the only one.
How many people have been deported?
In this particular go-round, there was a group of about 19 people they took to the grand jury. 11 of them they indicted. And I think just about all those people have chosen deportation. Now, there's other groupings around the country that they've gone after, and those people, from what we understand, are also choosing deportation.
So this is a national program. It's not
right.
Something
not,
specific.
Not just in Texas.
Uh-huh. Are there any other similar programs to Operation Fleeced America that you know about, or is it unique?
I can't say if it's unique or not. I don't know of any others, but that doesn't mean there aren't. I mean, it's only recently that I even knew about Operation Fleeced America. Total hypocrisy for them to be claiming that anyone is fleecing America when they're the biggest oppressors and exploiters in the history of mankind.
You are listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Up next, Travis Morales gives us some background information about the Blue Triangle Network. What is the Blue Triangle Network and how did it get started?
Came together with people 3 years ago to form the Blue Triangle Network in Dearborn, Michigan. And essentially we came together, you know, a lot of different kinds of people, but really came together to build resistance and a movement to stop just the many different ways the government was repressing and attacking Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants in the wake of 9/11. A big part of that was the way the government was rounding people up, holding them in secret without charges, denying them the right to see their lawyers, denying them the right to see members of their family, even denying the fact that they had them in custody. I mean, they were just shredding long-established legal rights in the name of the so-called war on terrorism, which is really a war on the people. So that was the impetus for us to come together 3 years ago and form this group.
What did you start doing first, and how has it developed?
We did a number of things. I mean, one was, in fact, actually before the Blue Triangle Network was formed, a few months before, we held the first National Day of Solidarity with Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants in, I don't know, 25 to 30 different cities. Actually, that was first proposed by the group La Resistencia. And one of the things we really encourage people to do is a way of exposing the fact that they were holding people in secret without charges was for people to wear blue triangles with the names of the people that we were able to get the names printed on them. Because after a certain point, fairly, I don't know, within a month or so after 9/11, the government stopped releasing the names of people that they had rounded up. So we were able to get some names, and so a big part of that was really exposing the fact that here in the United States there were people who were disappearing, people who one day were with their families and the next day were not seen, people didn't know where they were. That was sort of the forerunner of the founding of the Blue Triangle Network. And what we've done since then is, for instance, in a lot of the major anti-war mobilizations, we would take this message of people standing in solidarity with Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants and against this wave of repression and calling on people in the anti-war movement to make this a part of what they're about, to wear the blue triangles, to go out to churches, to community groups, to the campuses, exposing what the government was doing and calling on more people to become part of this and really taking, you know, a lot of our stand from the Martin Niemöller quotation, which I think is all the more important today. The quotation says basically, you know, first they came for the communists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics and I didn't speak up because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, but by that time, no one was left to speak up. Well, in this case of the United States, it's first they're coming for the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants. We have to take a stand. People have to take a stand to say, no, we're not going to allow this to happen.
Can you give us a little bit more of an idea of what these roundups really looked like? How were they gone about? Who were these people being rounded up, and what happened to them?
The government went at this in a number of different ways. In the immediate wake of 9/11, there were probably over 2,000, maybe 2,500 people just randomly picked up. I mean, these were people who, for some reason, they had their name, people who may have applied some change in their immigration status, people who were just picked up on the street and sweeps. They were going after people, and there wasn't like they were tying these people to any particular political activity or something. They were just going after people randomly, sweeping them up, and holding people in detention. And they came up with this creative use of the immigration law, because people may not know, but when people violate the immigration statutes, it's considered a civil case. So a lot of the rights that people have in criminal cases, they claim they don't have in these civil cases. It's just an administrative process. They would designate some of these cases as special interest to the government. And these were the people they could hold in secret. They wouldn't even put on the docket when their cases were coming up for review before an immigration judge. So there was this whole wave of, which was basically terrorizing whole communities of people throughout the country. So there was that whole wave of rounding people. I mean, families were being torn apart. People who had lived here, in some cases, for 20 years were being rounded up and held in secret. And it was just devastating to the lives of thousands and thousands and thousands of people. So there was that wave of roundup. There was also the fact that they were going after some of the different Muslim charities. Organizations like the Holy Land Fund, who played an extremely important role in the Middle East, Yugoslavia, and other places in providing medical care, providing aid to refugees in the Middle East. But the government was utilizing a statute or law that says that if someone or organization provides aid to some group that's somehow linked to a terrorist organization, they can seize their funds and shut them down and withhold the evidence of that so-called link. So that's what they did with the Holy Land Fund and a number of other charities, where they would go into court and say, well, we have evidence of them aiding terrorism, but yet they wouldn't have to say what that aid was because it would hurt national security to reveal that. And that's how they shut down a number of different organizations, including arresting people like Rabi Haddad, who was a Palestinian from Detroit, actually from Lebanon, rather, in Michigan, who was one of the founders and board members of the Global Relief Foundation. It was one of the largest Islamic charities in the U.S. and provided millions of dollars for projects ranging from like schools in places like Pakistan and Chechnya and giving food to people in Afghanistan. And they went after them. And I think part of the reason was they wanted to create a situation where people in the Middle East, refugees, had absolutely no way of getting any kind of aid except through government, U.S. government agencies. It was a way of making people there totally dependent on them, and also creating this hysteria within the U.S. And then after that, there were a number of criminal cases that were launched against, for instance, people may be familiar with the Lackawanna area of Buffalo. They went after a number of Yemeni Americans, people who'd been born here, but people whose parents were from Yemen, and accused them of aiding terrorism because they claimed some of them went to an al-Qaeda training camp in either Pakistan or Afghanistan a number of years ago when these youth thought they were going to some type of Islamic center to study. There was that case. There was the case of Abdul Jabbar Hamdan. They held him on essentially a 20-year-old minor visa violation. He was a student back in the 80s. And he had dropped one of his classes one semester because he was ill. So now, 20 years later, they went after him and ordered his deportation after living here all these years. So these are some of the different ways they've been going after people since 9/11.
Were these groups of people facing any repression from the government before 9/11? Has this all started just since then, or has it just increased?
Well, back in the 90s, they passed the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which they used to criminalize some Muslim Arab and South Asian immigrants. But this took a dramatic leap after 9/11 with these mass roundups and the holding of people without charges. And just the whole creation of this hysteria of essentially creating in people's minds the terror of the enemy within. I mean, it was very similar to what they did to the Japanese Americans during World War II. I mean, even before World War II, J. Edgar Hoover had written this report saying, Japanese Americans are no threat to the security of the United States, but yet, nonetheless, after Pearl Harbor, they rounded up like 110,000 Japanese Americans and Japanese immigrants and put them in concentration camps. It wasn't because they represented some threat, but because it was a way of creating this whole hysteria, this fear of the enemy within, so that people would go along with whatever measures the government would take. And I think there's a real element of that now, but also, this is how they've established a lot of these repressive measures. I mean, with the Patriot Act, for instance, where they can declare someone who's given money to some charity organization as a supporter of terrorism. They've passed these laws now that they can spy on organizations, they can infiltrate organizations, they can come into your house and take so-called evidence without you knowing it. They can spy on your email, your letters, you know, whole new levels of repression. And the way they're getting over on it was saying, well, we have to protect you. We have to protect Americans. This is part of how they're doing this.
How common has it been for someone who has been rounded up under these pretenses? Do they show up later? Do their families ever find out what happened to them?
Some people later who were initially rounded up, most of them, I think, have been deported. Some are still in jail. Eventually, most of them, the families found out, but sometimes they didn't find out until, like, for instance, there's a woman here in Houston named Patricia David. She's a black woman who was married to a Pakistani man, and he was in custody. Actually, he had been arrested before 9/11, released after a few months in jail, was rearrested after 9/11, and she talked to him one day in the detention center, and then a few days later she got a call from his family in Pakistan saying he'd been deported to Pakistan. I mean, this is how it's happened. I mean, there have been cases of like over 100 Pakistanis taken on a plane in the middle of the night from some of these detention centers and flown out of the country.
How are these cases being challenged, if at all, in the courts?
People have filed lawsuits, but it hasn't really been very successful. I mean, essentially, I mean, as they did with the, for instance, the enemy combatants case, which was actually a case of U.S. citizens being held by the government as enemy combatants and denied, you know, all the legal rights of the Constitution. The Supreme Court, what they really said was, you can hold people as enemy combatants, saying this to the government, but you have to give them a hearing in court, but you can hold them. And they have to have some neutral third party, i.e. a military tribunal that rules on this. So people have not been real successful in challenging this in the courts. There needs to be much more of a movement of all kinds of people saying, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. Because I think that's something that's very important for people to realize is that, again, this is how they've established a lot of the repressive mechanism is through going after the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants. I mean, this is how they've laid the basis for a police state in this country. Because there's nothing in the Patriot Act or a lot of these other laws that they've been passing that says that these are just applicable to Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants. I mean, it's horrible in and of itself what they're doing to these communities, and that is reason enough for people to say no, that you're not going to tear apart families, you're not going to demonize people, you're not going to basically create an atmosphere where people think they can firebomb mosques and get away with it. That's horrible in and of itself, but also people need to realize where this is headed, which is establishment of these police state measures that can be used against everyone and are being used against everyone, as we've seen in how anti-war demonstrations were attacked, how they've infiltrated different anti-war organizations they were doing during the Republican National Convention, just preventive detention, rounding people up, infiltrating organizations. Those are how they're using these laws.
How has your work with the Blue Triangle Network been heard and felt out in the community? Do you feel like people have been responsive in taking action and supporting and standing up for the rights of Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants? Or has it been frustrating? Or,
well, I guess more the frustrating part is trying to figure out the ways to get this out there. I mean, for instance, there was a case here a couple of years ago of the Kesba family. They were a Palestinian family that had been here for years. I mean, the father was, when he was young, was driven out of Palestine by the establishment of Israel and the occupation of Palestine. Then in the 67 war, they had to flee again, came to this country, and they applied for political asylum and had a bunch of children, some of whom were born here. And this got quite a bit of coverage here because he was someone who had established a business, was raising his kids here, they were going to school. The government just decided, we're going to deport you because you didn't... didn't accept your political asylum case. And there was a lot of public outcry. A couple of times the deportation was halted, but finally they did deport them. And I think a big part of the challenge is really figuring out how we can bring out to many more people what is happening to these communities, for people to hear the stories firsthand of these families that are being torn apart because someone dropped a class 20 years ago, which put them in violation of their student visa, and even though they went on to graduate from college and were working ever since then, of people who've lived here for years who maybe failed to fill out a form properly, or people who came here fleeing the persecution in their home countries because of what the U.S. has done there and then are being doubly persecuted here. I mean, people need to hear these stories. And I think that the more that they hear them, the more positive response there's been of people being outraged, like, why are you doing this to these people? And I think also, really bringing out to people that a couple of things. One is the thing I said earlier about how this is the doorway through which they are establishing these police state measures. I mean, here you have Bush, who thinks he's on a crusade of based upon fighting evil, the whole battle between good and evil, and that Islam is like a demon religion or whatever, which is really what Bush and just General Boykin and all these what I call Christian fascists, these Christian fundamentalists, are claiming. And part of that is going after these communities in this country. I mean, this is part of this whole repressive mechanism. It's part of what I consider their moves to establish a Christian fundamentalist theocracy in this country. And whether it's going after the Muslim, Arab, and South Asian immigrants, or going after gay people, or going after people who believe in the separation of church and state, or whatever. It's all part of this whole relentless drive of these Christian fascists and fundamentalists. What's happening to Hafiz is just one story of thousands and thousands and thousands of stories in this country, and millions around the world, of what this Bush regime is doing to people.
Again, this is Aisha Hafiz.
Is your husband currently in custody?
No, he's not. No, he's working to pay his SBA loan. He's still paying. I mean, every time you turn around, there's still a bill. He still pays it. He's still a bill, still pays it.
And what's the status with the court proceedings right now?
Well, we got to go back to court, and it's going to be the last final trial. Will be on June the 13th, and that's when his trial will start.
So he hasn't been in trial yet? It's been postponed?
We've been going to court and getting postponed because a prosecutor at one point was trying to get our attorney bumped off the case so that we would have to go out and afford another attorney. And, we would have lost a lot of money from that. That, of course, was his whole agenda, was to get our attorney kicked off the case. Because, one, we have a very good attorney who represents my husband. And that would be just another strategy to cost us more money. Which, I mean, they know convenience store owners don't make very much money. They make pennies on the dollar.
And can you say again what your husband's being charged with and what he's facing?
He is facing, first he was charged with false claim of citizenship. Then they went in and they charged him with bank fraud. And one of them was that he had taken a loan from the seller. Well, the seller's been paid back. Just everything. I mean, we didn't know that if he took a loan, if it wasn't disclosed to SBA, which we have evidence otherwise stating, that, he didn't know that he had broken any kind of law, But it's just crazy how he's facing basically going to prison for 30 years, and if he's not going to have to spend 30 years, then he'll be deported to Pakistan forever and never be able to ever come back to America. Which leaves me in a position, if I want to keep my family intact, then I will have to take my children and go to Pakistan and live in Pakistan the rest of my life. And it's been horrible because, we want to be able to go on with our life as normal, but having this hanging over your head every single day is like a death sentence. It's like a death sentence. It's like watching a man dying slowly. That's exactly how it is. And this is nothing but terrorism, and they call us terrorists. And all I can say is shame on them, because I wasn't raised this way. My father did not fight in Vietnam War to victimize people. My son is not in Iraq to victimize people. This one thing I will say, this is not going to stop just in Houston. It's not an isolated case, and it's a tragedy. It's a tragedy because, again, I will say, if these people check this off to make their own profit at the bank, because trust me, they make a very, and one thing I forgot to tell you, A lady, since I have went through Blue Triangle, has contacted me. She was an SBA job recruiter for Bank United back in 1999. She has told me that back in the days when she was recruiting for Bank United, the rumors were very, very heavy, that Bank United was doing fraudulent things in order to get SBA loans. And then she also told me that SBA had told Bank United not to do any more bank loans for Pakistani convenience store owners. I mean, you know, I'm just going, okay, this is great. And if anybody has any information about Bank United, I would suggest them to come forward and help people to keep their families intact from, you know, being victimized because of Bank United's scam.
What are the ways that people can support you in this struggle?
The way that I feel that they could support me is, I mean, you know, go to Congress. I've asked every Congress member, Tom DeLay, Al Green, Sheila Lee Jackson, I've asked every one of them to intervene. If they can intervene in the Terri Schiavo, why can't they intervene for my small children? That every one of them says, no, it's a federal case, we can't get involved. Well, Terri Schiavo's was a federal case too, but they got involved. And, you know, I just feel like, you know what, if these American banks and the American Title Company did injustice to the Pakistani people, then let them be held accountable for their crimes. Why should they be trying to say that all Pakistani people are cheaters? My husband wasn't a cheater. He didn't do anything. And now, you know, they're making all kinds of weird allegations that he committed some kind of marriage fraud with his first wife. He did not. His first wife has even told them that they were truly, truly married, but yet they want to harass her. And now, I mean, that's their way. They're trying to get every little thing that they can get, every single little thing that they can get to deport him. That's their aim, their goal, their mission, to deport him. And for what? He didn't commit any crime. The one thing that I would like to bring out to everybody's attention is that, you know, in our Pakistani society, everybody just thinks that it's not going to happen to them, or there may be something underlying more than what they know. There's nothing underlying. There's nothing hidden. It's just a matter that this Operation Flee America is going to continue throughout the United States. And every person better go back before they even apply for citizenship. They better go back and look at every loan document that they've ever signed. Don't assume that somebody else did their job properly. Go back and look for yourself, because it could cost them their whole entire life, meaning their children, their wives, their homes, every single thing, even the clothes almost practically on their back. They better go back for their own safety, for their own protection. Look at these loan documents. Make sure that where it says, are you a United States citizen, if it is checked off correctly or if it is not. And if it is not, go back to the bank and make them correct it, because it could cost you your whole life. That's my whole message right there. And as far as them singling out people, they shouldn't be re-victimizing. And I'll say re-victimizing a person who's been victimized. That's one thing I would like to say. It's just so heart-wrenching, because it's fearful. And it's like, you know, everybody keeps saying to us, Aisha, you should just plead guilty, sell everything, and go back, because you know what? The system is going to drain you practically dry and leave you on the streets, penniless. You know, yes, they're putting me at a point where I may have to go on welfare, you know? And, yeah, it just really kills me. It really does. I mean, for a man who worked hard, who contributed to the American economy, you're throwing him in Pakistan, putting his family on welfare. Now, how is that doing good to America? Just tell me that. That's what I'd like to know.
What else is the Blue Triangle doing to support this case?
Well, we've been doing broadcast emails to different groups, organizations, all kinds of contacts, calling on people to write the judge demanding the charges be dropped, write the prosecutor, write different Congress people, to expose what is happening, to get the word out to many more people, and for people to speak out demanding that this not continue, that these charges be dropped. I mean, part of what they've tried to do is, with a lot of the Muslim, Arab, and South Asians, is do this in secret so that people didn't even know it was happening. I mean, there was a big splash when the arrest happened, but then it's no more in the news. It's covered up after that. Particularly, they don't bring out what the devastating effect this is having on people's families. I mean, people who've been here for long periods of time, have raised children, have are married. I mean, they're just tearing these families apart, as in the case of Hafiz and his wife Aisha, having kids here in the U.S. and then going after him, trying to deport him.
How can people get involved to help support this particular case and to get involved with the Blue Triangle Network?
One thing they can do is, you know, we would really encourage people to visit the Blue Triangle website, bluetriangle.org. When they go to it, they can read about some of these different cases. They can contact us through the email there. I think it would just be very important for people to go to the website and to, you know, look at some of the different cases that are happening, the different ways that the government is going after people. Go to the website, email us. We have this a fact sheet that we put together that details in quite a bit how the government has been going after these communities in the wake of 9/11. It details the specifics of a lot of these different cases, but also goes through in all the different ways the laws have been changed and these passing of these different laws, like the Patriot Act and other ways that they've really ratcheted up the whole repressive apparatus in the wake of 9/11.
Another potential law that would sacrifice civil liberties for safety is the Real ID Act.
The U.S. House of Representatives is now considering H.R. 418, the Real ID Act, which was introduced by Judiciary Committee Chairman Congressman James Sensenbrenner. The bill includes provisions that threaten civil liberties, undermine national security, restrict states' rights, and decrease protections available to victims of torture and persecution. Speaking to the Real ID Act is Arti Shahani from Families for Freedom and Jeff Deist, who is the press secretary for Congressman Ron Paul, a leading opponent of the bill.
In February, the House passed the National ID Card bill. It wasn't presented that way. It was presented as immigration reform or amnesty reform or border reform, but it dealt with none of those things. It had nothing to do with immigration policy. It's just setting up driver's license standards. So the question then became, will the Senate pass the bill as well? And what's happening today is Congress is busy passing a so-called supplemental spending bill, as though the 13 normal appropriations bills weren't enough. The sponsor of the bill and the House leadership presented it as an immigration reform bill, and it's a party thing, so all the Republicans in the Republican House quickly fall into line. The Democrats are trying to look a little bit more tough, so most of them fell in line, and the few that did object didn't object on the grounds that a national ID is Orwellian or a national ID is not proper in a supposedly free society. No, their objections were that, you know, their constituencies are illegal immigrants. They've inserted this H.R. 418, the National ID Card bill that already passed. They've inserted that in a very crafty fashion into this spending bill, and it's going to be passed by the House and sent over to the Senate, where the senators will be voting on a much larger spending bill rather than voting up or down on the National ID bill itself. What it means is that it makes it a lot harder for any senators who might have not liked the idea of a National ID card to vote against it, because it's now a tiny part of a much bigger spending bill.
The Real ID Act is a sweeping measure to curtail immigrants' rights in terms of livelihood, like driver's licenses, in terms of access to courts if they're being deported. For the first time since the Civil War, the Real ID Act actually proposes to suspend habeas corpus. Other things the Real ID does is it empowers bounty hunters, private police forces, to go ahead and arrest immigrants that may be in deportation proceedings with virtually no oversight. It also gives the Department of Homeland Security carte blanche to basically go ahead and do what it wants to at the border. That's basically what Real ID does. Why this is so terrifying is a matter of process. I mean, the bill itself is a monster, and I think that there are certain people in Congress that have been itching to pass something like this. They've tried time and time again. Last year it didn't work, and now they're trying to get it through quietly with the appropriations bill. But just historically, the last time Congress made sweeping anti-immigrant measures was in 1996, and they did it the exact same way. They couldn't get it to pass through the House and Senate independently, so they tacked it onto an appropriations bill. A conference committee got together. At midnight, they made final changes, and kabam, you get an anti-immigrant bill that is having lasting impacts on us.
The ID card bill, first and foremost, it forces all the states to have certain characteristics on their driver's license. and it forces them all into this federal regime. It also allows the Homeland Security Department head to, in the future, determine, you know, without going to Congress, determine what standards need to be on there. That could be biometrics, it could be a fingerprint, it could be all kinds of things, RFID, you name it. It's very open-ended, and it allows future Homeland Security chiefs to do that without a congressional vote. But it also forces all the states to link to what's called the driver's license agreement, which is something that the motor vehicle folks have wanted for a long time. And it's in that driver's license agreement, the DLA, where Canada and Mexico could be linked to our driver's license database. So it becomes sort of a tri-national database. So that's essentially what the National ID card does. It takes the first steps towards a domestic passport of sorts. For the time being, it's still going to be a driver's license. It's still going to have the name of your state on it. But in essence, it's going to be a federal ID. And they know that maybe people aren't emotionally ready to just be handed federal papers, so they're going to ease us into it. And of course, incrementalism is the way Washington operates. Both parties have totally sold out on the concept of federalism, you know, shared power between federal and state governments.
In the Senate, Democrats have had absolutely no backbone about this stuff. Feinstein of California actually tried to pass a sense of the Senate bill to stop immigration provisions from being thrown into the military appropriations. You have a small pocket of senators that are saying, listen, we're not saying we're for it or against it. We're just saying we have to have a debate.
It had a provision, an express provision, that allows the Secretary of Homeland Security to suspend domestic laws. It's open-ended. It could, you know, the suspension of law, God knows what that could mean in 5 or 10 years. They could decide to suspend all kinds of laws, like habeas corpus or something, if we had another terrorist event or something like that.
In terms of the types of things that this will permit, if it's passed, with habeas, for example, habeas is like the emergency valve you pull when the government is doing something wrrong to you. It's the thing that you file to say, my arrest is unlawful, my detention is unlawful, my deportation is unlawful, and Real ID would take habeas away. So there's no safety valve anymore.
It was pretty eye-opening. I mean, there were even some Democrats who objected to it, who said, wow, this is pretty open-ended. We're letting the Homeland Security's suspend laws to you know, get things done, so to speak. It's more of the same. It's where we've been headed for a long time. I mean, they want you to virtually everything you do now has a federal component. If you want to fly on an airplane, that's FAA. If you want to get a job, you have to show your status as a legal citizen or a resident. If you want to enter a federal building, it's no longer a case where a person can live their life without having to deal with the federal government, which is why no state is going to refuse this agreement. Because, as our colleague pointed out, they're going to make non-citizens essentially out of their citizens if they don't accept the ID.
That was Jeff Deist, Press Secretary for Congressman Ron Paul, and Arti Shahani of Families for Freedom.
There is more information about the Real ID Act available on the web. The act is known as H.R. 418. For more information about the Blue Triangle Network, check out bluetriangle.org.
We appreciate and enjoy feedback from you, our dear listeners. Contact us at info@circlearadio.org. Circle A Radio is on the first and third Wednesdays of the month from 6 to 7 here on your KBOO. Tune in May 18th for our next show. Circle A would also like to wish a fond farewell to Robert Jefferson, KBOO's PM News and Public Affairs Director. Take care, Robert.
Thanks for listening.